Hey everyone, this is the Love of Cinema podcast. We like to talk movies. If you like to talk movies too, you come to the right place.
I don't want to do anything in the romance space because it doesn't feel like it has any... If these two people came out of the screen, they wouldn't be able to walk because there's no feet. They're so plastic, right? So I was like, I wanted to create a love story which has a little bit of personality, which has a little bit of vulnerability, and we feel it, right? Your Mani Ratnam films, couples, basically, or, you know, your Korean films, your general, you know, so classics, so to speak. So I was like, okay, maybe somewhere down the line, I'll work on it. But Sapta is the first script that I ever wrote.
The 2019 Kannada noirish thriller Kavaludari combines a traffic cop's pursuit of solving a four-decades-old triple murder cold case with political commentary. When I first watched it a few years ago, I was taken by its treatment, which harks back to the classic American noirs and investigative procedurals. Hemant M. Rao, who wrote and directed Kavaludari, also made the recent runaway success, the two-part Kannada romantic drama Sapta Sagaradache Ello, with the two parts cleverly titled Side A and Side B. Sapta Sagaradache Ello is a remarkably immersive love story that succeeds in cranking up the emotions without turning up the melodrama. Shunning fakeness and embracing realism, both parts suck you in from the very get-go and don't let go till the beautiful poetic culmination of Side B. The C plays a crucial character in the film, and perhaps it's not coincidental that what makes Sapta special is the film's emotional ebb and flow. This is Himanshu, and you're listening to the Love of Cinema podcast. But before moving on, an important reminder. If you enjoy organic conversations centered on Indian cinema, Love of Cinema podcast was created for people just like you. So if you enjoy the podcast, please do consider supporting the show. Love of Cinema podcast is my passion project, and with every episode, I've attempted to create something that cinephiles will continue to find value, not just today, but over time as well. If you find value in the conversations on the pod, please do consider supporting the show. Your support will help me continue creating content with shelf life for fans of Indian cinema everywhere. You'll find the link to support the show in the show notes. You can also support the show directly from the podcast website. It's fast, it's easy, and your support is greatly appreciated. Also, if you like the episode, please share the episode on social media, as that will help other people discover the podcast. Back to today's episode. I was delighted to have Hemant on the pod to chat about his lovely films. Besides his films, we also chatted about his early days assisting Girish Kasaravalli, co-writing Andhadhun with Sriram Raghavan, his love for graphic novels, and stuff like Hemant's favorite B film. Here goes. Hey Hemant, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm great.
great, Hemant. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. I'm really excited to talk about your films. You know, I'm going to try to pick your brain in terms of your writing style, your style of direction, your style of storytelling. So Hemant, I wanted to start from your early days. You know, I know that you assisted Kasaravalli on Gulabi Talkies. So right off the bat, like, what was that like? Because, you know, he's such a big legend. And I'm assuming that you must be fairly young when you got this job.
Yeah. So yeah, for sure. I mean, working with Kasaravalli sir was, you know, for a very young, like you rightly said, I was probably 23, 20, you know, 20, 24, early 23, actually, to be honest. So to be accurate, so I knew about the persona and the legend that he is, but I didn't know, I didn't sort of really understood his genius until I worked with him. So only when I started working with him, actually, there are many things that he used to do that I understood after 6-7 months after assisting him. You know, I couldn't understand what I was doing at that point of time. But 6 months later, after I saw the film on the screen, I was like, I was able to put two and two, you know, and figure out, oh, that's how, you know, that's why this was done. My appreciation to towards Kasrali sir has grown with time, if that makes sense. Because the more cinema I understood, the more I appreciate, you know, what a master of the craft he is. So it truly, you know, I'm very, very lucky to have assisted somebody like sir, because I've learned a lot from him. Although while working with him, I didn't realize I was learning those lessons. You know, it's like I said, it's much later. So it was interesting. One of the big misconceptions that I had is that not many people might know this, but Kasrali sir is a fantastic actor. Like, he is the kind of a director who actually shows what the actor should do. He'll act it out and show it to the actor. So when I saw that as an assistant, I was heartbroken because I don't know head or tail of you know, of acting. So for the first schedule, I was so depressed because I was like, I can't fucking do this job because I am not a actor. I will never be able to direct because I don't know how to act. So that sort of pushed me towards reading about acting and trying to understand how different there are different methods to, you know, the performance arts. So I started reading up about acting, not to ever want to be in front of the camera, but to sort of understand how to direct. And then slowly I realized that not all directors direct by acting. So it is not necessary. You can still get work out of actors by, you know, not showing them how to act. So that was one of the interesting incidents. But yeah, it was an absolute, you know, pleasure. And it was like my film school in many ways.
Right. You actually did engineering, right? You never went to film school.
Yeah, I passed out of engineering and then I sort of was very confused, like many engineers.
Like most of us, yes.
Yeah. And, but one thing I realized by doing engineering is, and I'm always thankful for it, and given a chance, I'd walk the same steps because I'm the person I am because of the wrong decisions that I take as well. So I realized I don't want to do one thing by doing engineering. So I started off with knocking off one thing off the list, and that is one way to go about it. So yeah, that's how I got into filmmaking.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you had approached Shriram Raghavan with the story of Kavaludari.
Yes, that's
right. Is that accurate? Okay, and yeah. This was with the hopes that he would direct it, or you just wanted him to have a read or something like that?
I was just shooting in the dark, man. I was very desperate at that point of time. The thing was very unfortunate is that, and it holds true to this day as well, Kasrali sir is such a celebrated filmmaker. Not many Kannadigas know of him. The Kannada film industry doesn't value his work as much as it should. This is my personal opinion. In the sense that, so I finished assisting Kasrali sir on Gulabi Talkies. And I had done another proper commercial film, but it had a nice premise and it had its heart in the right place. There was a story that was being, you know, narrated. So I got two back-to-back experiences of working in a very art film, you know, very intellectual space, which is made primarily for film festival consumption and, you know, that's the circles that I was also operating in because I used to make it a point to go to Kerala to watch film festivals and stuff, you know, every year. And at the same time, right after that, I did this commercial film called Savari, which was a remake of a Telugu film called Gamyam. So that experience was in the very popular cinema section. And, you know, both films did really well. And in the theater, of course, Savari did really well. Gulabi Talkies didn't even release. Nobody saw it. So my first film, I was proudly going and telling everybody I was part of this film called Gulabi Talkies. And they were like, no, we've never heard of it. Who's the director? I was like, Girish Kasrali. And he was like, who is he? Is he new? And the weird thing is, I got sick of this ecosystem because I was not getting opportunities, and my kind of writing and my kind of thinking was getting turned down very often by producers and, you know, by filmmakers here. So I was looking for work and I was like, okay, what are my options? Maybe I can do a bit of advertising. So I did a little bit of, you know, freelance work. And then the idea came across that I should go to Bombay because there were a lot of films that were coming out of Bombay, which I could identify with, at least the style of storytelling. And I'd seen Johnny Gaddar, and, you know, there were some three or four filmmakers that I'd sort of picked and said, okay, these are the filmmakers that I want to, you know, just shoot in the dark. So I wrote one very, like one of those, you have one too many drinks and you just type out a mail. So I just wrote like on random mail, and I kept it ready. So I went to Bombay, and a couple of my friends, one of my cinematographer friends, Nandakishore, who happened to shoot my first film, I was staying with him in Bombay. He was working there. So he and a couple of his roommates, they helped with some email addresses. So I just sent these emails to random directors that I had sort of said, okay, these are people that I want to work with, or I see myself, you know, being some tiny branch in under that big tree. So Vishal sir was one, Anurag Kashyap was one, then Dibakar Banerjee was one, Sriram Ragavan was one. So they were like, Neeraj Pandey was one. He had just done A Witness Day at that time. So they were like these, you know, filmmakers who had sort of taken the scene by storm. And I was
and
like,
what
okay,
did
I'll
your
just...
email say? Like, hi, I am Hemant. I want to work with you.
No, it. So I had tried the whole formal approach, saying, hi, you know, this is my CV. So I was like, every guy is going to write like this. And I think I was like a couple of drinks down. So I just wrote like a very free flowing, you know, I'm a very frustrated guy from Bangalore, round peg in a square hole. And, you know, or you can Google all the cliches and just, you know, I just sort of put together a very heartful, sincere rant, basically saying that I'm sick of this place. You know, in my free time, I'm thinking of scheming and thinking of doing bank robberies to fund my films. There's like stuff like
that.
You're
kidding me? Are you serious?
No, I'm serious. So I sent this across. I didn't get any reply. And I was like, okay, I blew it. Nobody's going to care about this. I might as well go back. The first person who replied to that email was Shira. He said, I read the mail. It was pretty funny. We'd love to meet you. And he sent me his number. Just like that. So I called him and he was like, yeah, come over. And I went and met him. And it was just a casual talk. He was like, where are you from? The weird thing that I understood why I prefaced this conversation with Kasaravelli sir is that every single filmmaker, I don't think it's the email that got their attention. It's the fact that I had assisted Kasaravelli sir. Every single filmmaker was like, oh, wow, you've assisted somebody like Kasaravelli. So you must have some stuff, you know. So I got to meet all these filmmakers one by one. I met Dibakar sir. I met Vishal sir. I met Sriram. With Sriram, the connection was instant because he was also FTII grad. Kasaravelli sir was also FTII. And Sriram sir, I think, knew Kasaravelli sir. Many times his junior, I think. So the conversation was a lot more free flowing with him. And the kind of films that I have grown up watching and has had the maximum influence were old school film noir films. So all the films, I was able to relate to the films that Shira was talking about. So that's how the thing happened. And the bond was established. And I pitched the idea of Kavaludari then because I just had like a one page. It was just an idea of, you know, these bones being found. And he found it interesting. And he was like, you know, work on it. And then I went back to Bangalore. I did another film with Puneet sir. I came back to Bangalore because I got the chance to work with Puneet sir, Puneet Rajkumar. And it was a very interesting subject. We were doing a film about the Bellary mines and the mining ore that was happening there, and set against that backdrop, there is this, you know, very Rajneeti space, you know, it's in that serious political drama. So, and that's a lovely space that I've grown up, you know, that I'd watched a lot of. Like, one of my favorite films was Mississippi Burning. So, you know, it was in that space. So I really was tempted. I had a opportunity to assist Dibakar Banerjee on LSD. But at the same time, this opportunity opened up to come back to Bangalore to work with Puneet sir as a chief AD. So I was like, any day working in my language to tell a story that is, you know, of my people would be more exciting. So I came back, and that's the rest is, you know, a long answer for the question.
No, I hope it was entertaining. This is very interesting. And then, so you were always in touch with Shriram, and then when the time came for Andhadhun, you collaborated.
Yeah. So what happened was, after Prithvi, again, there was a bit of a lull, because at some point of time, you have to figure out when you become an independent director, right? I mean, that filmmakers who take the assisting route will be able to understand when I say that the biggest trick is to figure out when to go independent. So you need to know enough of the craft, but you need to also be innocent enough to take that plunge. That's a very thin line. And you always feel like, you know, you're jumping too early or you're jumping too late. So, but after Prithvi, I was like, it was itching, because this was already about year 8 or 9, after getting into the film space. So I was like, now I have to do something independent. So when I jumped in is when I started writing more, started, you know, exploring more opportunities, and hit several roadblocks and dead ends. So one of the points, again, when I was completely down and out, I was like, okay, you know, maybe I can go back to Bombay and reconnect with Shriram. And, you know, so I wrote back to him. He was sweet enough to, you know, he remembered me, thankfully. And then we went back, and that's how the idea, we were actually jamming on a multiple ideas. I was just meeting in his office, discussing idea after idea. And he would say, this is interesting. He was at the back of Agent Vinod at that point of time. And we had a couple of, you know, interesting ideas. And then we'd meet up, you know. So the thing with Shriram is, after 6 o'clock is when the bottles come out. So we're waiting till sundown, and then we each have a couple of drinks, and then we jam again and discuss films. And it's just a lot of fun. So a lot of learning about filmmaking, film writing that happened for me in that time. Then I came back to Bangalore because it was never my plan to stay indefinitely. So I came back to Bangalore. I happened to find this French short film, and I sent it across to him and saying, maybe, you know, we can, you know, take a look at this. I think you'll enjoy it. So middle of the night at around 11:30 or 11:45, I still remember, he called me and he's like, we have to make this. We are making this. Let's work on this. This is the idea. So that's how Andhadhun happened. And we got to the interval point, and then we were not able to crack the second arc. It was just not landing. By then, Shriram was also dabbling with Badlapur. So he moved to Badlapur, and this sort of stayed in the unfinished folder. And I was little, you know, neither here nor there, because I was not part of Badlapur. I had no idea that, you know, he had told me, of course, that he was working on another script, but I was not part of the, you know, development side. So I was here. So I was like, okay, now is my chance to make my film. So that's when I, you know, tried and made my first film. And yeah.
You co-wrote Andhadhun. Could you talk about a scene or a sequence from that film, you know, that was somewhat of a challenge to crack at that point of time in your journey as a screenwriter, as a director?
Yeah. One of the things that for us, in the draft that I was working, second half, of course, we couldn't crack. It was just getting stuck to, you know, at that point. But the thing where he goes blind, right, with regard to how does she go blind? I mean, how does she make him go blind? Right, that whole track is something that, like, I had to talk to ophthalmologists to figure out. Right, I was like, okay, how can somebody make somebody, you know, how can you take somebody's eyesight like that? How does it work? So that whole thing of, we need to know, if he loses his eye, there's this guy who's walking around pretending to be blind. Somewhere in the story, if he were to actually go blind, it would get really interesting. So how do we make that happen? So that was something that was a very, challenging thing. But the beauty of how it was figured out is when I saw the film. Before the release, Sriram had me over to watch the film once. So when I saw the film, it's like a dialogue that just, it's one of those very complex things that you think cannot be figured out, and it just gets fixed in one dialogue. Where Tabu says, one of the characters asks, so how did you do it? So he says, Google is there, no? You will get anything with Google. I was like, wow, you are not answering the question. You are not showing how, but you still convince the audience, because everybody is aware that sabkut Google mein milta hai, That I thought was genius. Sometimes it takes, many months before you crack something so simple.
Right. And it works. Yeah. Just that.
Yeah.
That reason works just fine. Were you present on the sets of that film as well? Like, did you assist Sriram? No. So you were only involved with the writing?
Yeah. But only the first half, actually.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. It was the second half.
Yeah, the film is quite different in the second half from the short film, right? I mean, the short film is just that person at...
The short film, I think, if I'm not mistaken, ends with the guy playing the song, if memory serves me right, if the pianist playing the song, pretending, to not see. I think the short film sort of ends there. It doesn't open up beyond that. So,
correct.
Yeah, the police, the cop, her having an affair with the cop, and all those aspects in terms of her coming over suddenly. There was another little kid who we had written in as a character who discovers that this guy is fooling around. So he keeps setting traps. When he comes into the house, there is a rope that is tied.
Okay.
Our man has to cross the rope. By crossing the rope, it becomes very clear that he can see. So he realizes that the kid has caught him. But two beats later, he actually loses his eyesight. So the kid is now unsure if he's actually blind or if he is actually, bluffing. So there are a lot of these multiple things that were there, which didn't make it to the final thing. But yeah, it was a great film to be part of, in some small capacity.
Absolutely lovely film. And now let's talk about Kavaludari. And Hemant, what I love about this film is that, for me, it was like many things rolled into one. Like you said, since you're a big fan of film noir, this film is like a true blue noir, which harks back to classic American film noirs. But it's also like an emphatic character study of a cop. There's also commentary on the 70s and the emergency. What was the germ of this film to begin with? Like, was this the fanboy in you of film noir wanting to do something in the similar space?
It wasn't genre driven, actually. It was just a simple observation that I happened to come across around my house. There was a lot of, so Bangalore has been slowly expanding. There's a lot of infrastructure developments. Roads are not recognizable because, 10 years ago, the way the roads were to how they are now, there are suddenly these small flyovers. Like, they're not big, giant infrastructure developments. They're all little band-aids to small, complex problems. There are these tiny, tiny problems that are being, made here and there. Typical example of poor planning, right? In from a city perspective. So there's a lot of constant digging up of roads. So there's a road that I kept visiting, that was close to my house that I kept seeing. And I always wondered, what if they find bones here? What if they're like these series of bones? What if a murder gets uncovered? And that idea was very film noirish, right? I mean, that kind of setup itself is like if I were to tell somebody, there's this film, and they dig up something and they find a body, but nobody knows if it was a murder, it was a suicide, was it natural death. That feels like it's a premise for a 1940s black and white film. So it instantly felt like I should treat it with noir undertones. So, and then I started developing the character, and it started from there, and that's how the film sort of, you know, took form. But for me, the interesting thing was the commentary aspect. How do I bring in the slightly socio-political commentary? It went very unnoticed. So those are things that I really was like, okay, this is something that I get to do, which is interesting, you know, for me, which I felt is something new.
Yeah, the commentary is certainly there. And like you said, you know, it's unfortunate if it went unnoticed. Because if I'm not mistaken, I think Anantnag kind of mentions it twice, you know, in his dialogue that after the emergency, a lot of rowdies and criminals got it.
Yeah.
Politics. And, you know, if you really think about it, I mean, everything has a domino effect and there are ramifications to that. And so that's definitely there. Some scenes, Hemant, I wanted to, again, pick your brain on. The one scene that I really like is when Shyam's going through the old case files to identify the remains that were found under the flyover. And we see there's a documentary on the emergency that's playing on the big screen in the background. And we see people getting up and leaving as he keeps sifting through those case files and narrowing down the potential candidates for the found remains. Can you talk about that scene? I really loved that scene. And why did you think about, depicting that in that particular fashion?
So for me, the one of the very weird film influence is that there is a Malayalam film. I don't know what's happening with my memory these days. It was shot by Mr. Sunny Joseph, the Malayalam cinematographer, very celebrated cinematographer. I happened to work with Sunny sir. He was the first cinematographer that I worked with. He's also proper FTII, you know. So he did a short film that my director, who did Prithvi, Jacob Varghese, his short film, Sunny sir was the cameraman. So he, while reading up about Sunny Joseph sir and trying to understand, because I was like, okay, who is the cinematographer? What has he done before? What films? So there's one film that he had done, which is a Malayalam film. It won the National Award, very famous film. I don't know if he directed it or if he was a cinematographer on it. It was about a boy who goes missing during the emergency. There were a lot of stories of lockup death, people just going missing, right? So that film, I forget the name of the film. It's a Malayalam film. It's a haunting film, very beautiful film. So the idea of some people going missing and being unaccounted for, right? During the emergency had sort of stayed in my head. So when I was doing research and trying to figure out how do I, you know, because that entire treatment of that scene is slightly exposition heavy, on paper at least. So I wanted to find a way where I can visually make the exposition less, heavy, and try and see if I can visually engage the brain for the audience to try and see if they can figure out, if they can do the lifting of the exposition instead of me explaining the whole thing, if I can put it in such a way that they get a little bit and I give a little bit of information and they piece it together. So that's how that thing of lots of people missing, lot of case files, amidst that they find this group of people who went missing, and that's there, but it can't be the first group that they find missing. So there has to be a little more drama there. So there is a group of three people. So every time there's a group of three people, Shyam is shown to be hesitant. He's like, because he's looking at it from a perspective of three bodies. So three bodies were found. So there are three skeletons. Then he sees a boy. So if it is a boy, then he discards the case file. So if it's a girl, then he holds. So there's actually a sequence where there is one more girl before the actual girl is found. So that is to show that, oh, maybe he's thinking that, you know, it was another girl. So I wanted to sort of drop these visual breadcrumbs for the audience to extrapolate what is it that he was reading. So, but when you score it with that music and that treatment, and it's like a stylistic piece. But yeah, I had a lot of fun. But the interesting thing about it is that when we were shooting it, nobody on set knew what was happening. Like, because it was so complex in my head, I didn't know myself how I am going to get it across. So I was trying to figure it on the go. I was like, okay, now I want a close-up. Next shot I want from this angle. So I'm usually very planned in the sense that if I go to one axis, I try and finish the axis fully so that they don't have to light the same axis again. So in this case, I was like all over the place. My DOP was like, Advait was like, okay, what do I shoot next? I was like, okay, I want a close-up of his eyes. My actor was like, what is it that you're shooting? So only when I did the piece together, it showed it. They were like, okay, okay. Now it was worth all the confusion that all of us experienced on set. So, yeah.
That's a great sequence. And was that a real documentary that's playing on the screen in the background? Or
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Which I want... It's a documentary on the emergency. I don't know exactly now. Well, my associate found the documentary. I think it was a program on the emergency that was done by NDTV, if I'm not mistaken, long back. So for me, the whole point is that there was a certain amount of hero worship towards, you know, Mrs. Indira Gandhi. She might have been doing good work, but just by showing her, there was a very famous saying in that time. In fact, when I narrated the story, Anant Nag sir was active in politics. He was part of the JP movement. He, in fact, was very much in opposition to the establishment. So he was able to relate and give me a lot of insight. So he told me that there were lots of instances where the people used to say that if you put a donkey and make it stand for elections and put a photo of Indira Gandhi behind, the donkey will still win the election. So my thing is that the criminalization of Indian politics, the emergency, in fact, opened up a lot of doors where a lot of, you know, uncouth elements started getting into politics. And I feel the political commentary is that, you know, many years later, 30 years later, we find bones. History always finds a way to repeat itself. I feel that happening today also, you know, where we are not questioning the actual reason for a candidate. We are just looking at somebody behind them. And that generally doesn't bode well for democracy, right? So that's the basic idea. But right. I don't think anybody, I'm very glad, I'm so happy that after all these years, you are saying, was that in documentary about Indira Gandhi? Because I don't think anybody saw it.
No, that's one of my favorite scenes from the film. And actually, when I saw it, you know, I realized it's about the emergency and everything. But then the subtext, the commentary really hit hard when Anant Nag says it twice right there. After the emergency, a lot of rowdies and criminals made their way into the politics. Hemant, another scene from the film that I love is, this is again like a classic, 50s. I don't know if I should call this noir, but this is like a classic, like a buddy cop scene, or, you know, like a cop drama scene, you know, is where Anand Nag and Muthanna and Shyam, they're in the car, and where they bond for the first time, you know, where he tells Shyam that about the accident in which he lost his wife and his daughter. And he says, I lost them because I was obsessed with solving this case. And again, that is such a classic, like, noir, you know, a person who has lost everything, especially the close and dear ones. Can you talk a little bit about that scene?
Yeah, I mean, I like doing a lot of research when I'm trying to do films that are of a certain reality. I try and familiarize myself with that reality. My simple philosophy is that, and I think this comes from somebody like Kasrali sir. If I'm making a film about, let's say, a bus conductor, or an auto rickshaw driver, in the off chance that auto rickshaw driver were to watch the film, it should feel like I've represented him properly. I have tried and understand what his life is. So for me, I interviewed a lot of cops and spoke to them, and I realized that, you know, it's not a very high paying job. And it is certainly not a very appreciated job, because people generally have either a fear of them or a disregard towards them. They have the opinion that, you know, they are good for nothing. They're corrupt. So what is the payback then, right? There must be something weirdly satisfying about the job, right? So that's when I was able to find a correlation to filmmaking, right? When you're making a film, it is, nobody gives a damn about, you know, your film will be dismissed in 2.5 hours in one viewing, and people will be like, yeah, it's okay, one time watch, or, you know, we'll OTT, we'll see, not in the theater. So it's a very, so why do you do it then? You know, it's a very weird thing. But that kind of obsession can have repercussions with your personal life. As a filmmaker, you know, it's difficult to, your partner sees most of the backlash of it, in a way, in the sense that you don't have a structure. Holidays cannot be planned. So you tend to give more, even though you're in one moment, your brain is working somewhere else. So a lot of cops, when they were able to speak about it, it felt like, I am able to relate to this. This is a very human emotion. I relate to it. Anybody who does their job way too seriously will relate to this. So that is something that I wanted to, you know, sort of be like, that's not a very good way also, right? You have to find that balance. So the idea of regret is like, because of that, was something that I felt should be shown. You know, it's, we don't often see it, because it's usually the obsession is glorified. So in many ways, Sam is at the beginning of that spectrum of obsession. Muthanna, you know, has walked on that road and got his, you know, sort of reward. So in many ways, he's like trying to impart wisdom and say, this doesn't end well. You know, this kind of obsession doesn't end well. So that's the basic structure. So, yeah.
And what can you tell us about Suman Ranganathan's casting as Madhuri? That was a great surprise, because I saw her after a long time.
Dude, she is just something else. I mean, she was working as a heroine when I was born in 1983. And when I saw her for the first time on the sets of Sawari, that's when I saw her. I had the pleasure of working with her. She did a special number in that film. Called Poliputta. So I met her and I was like, this is this is an anomaly, because it feels like she's just woken up from a deep slumber. She's like a mermaid who's never aged, you know. She's like everything that you say about the quintessential diva figure. She was that. And I was starstruck. I was really starstruck. And that usually doesn't happen to me. So when I saw Suman ma'am for the first time, I was like, wow. So when I was writing this role, it was like, there's only one person who can do this. There's nobody else. If she doesn't do this role, I'll have to scrap it and write another track. So that's how badly I wanted her for it. In fact, I told her also, I was like, if you say no to it, then I won't be shooting the scene. I will be removing it from the story. So that's it. It was like that. So yeah, it was fun working with her.
Hemant, are you the kind of director who, before starts on a particular picture, a particular film, he tells his team that, hey, these two films are going to be our reference points that we keep on going back to whenever we are in trouble or whenever, we are caught in a bind?
Yeah, I know it's a very common practice. I don't do it with the team because my fear is that somewhere... it's a question of letting go of control, right? Directing is primarily, you know, slowly over a period of time, allow other people to come in and making it their own. So I feel a little wary of doing that, because I don't know if subconsciously if the films will start, if those two, you know, sort of moral compass films will start influencing at a deeper level, at a subconscious level. So if it is going to influence anybody, then it should influence me. And I will at least be self-aware about where the influence is coming from. So usually for every film, I'll have one film that is like a reference point for me personally, which I don't even share with any member of the team. So what we do is, like, with regard to cinematography with Kavaludari, there was a lot of frames, a lot of films, a lot of space, general exploration of that space that, you know, I sort of cast a wide net and said, this is the kind of tones. And incidentally, Advait is a very big fan of, you know, contrast, shadows, and all the noir elements are something that for a cinematographer, it's like, you know, kid in a candy store, right? So to create those things. So he gravitated towards it naturally. So for me, there was a reference point, which was Secret in Their Eyes. So that was my sort of reference point, not in terms of any particular scene or story. It was more with regard, you know, when you watch a film, there's a certain feeling you get. When I made my first film, Godi Banna Sadharana Maikar 2, the reference point for that was Good Will Hunting. The films are not even in the same ballpark. This film is about an old man who is played by Anant Nag, who goes missing because he has Alzheimer's. And his son goes looking for him. That is the story. And how he gets caught in a bind. Good Will Hunting is Good Will Hunting. So the two films are not related. But I wanted to create a feeling that I felt when I watched Good Will Hunting. So for me, Kavaludari was like, I wanted to leave the audience feeling like how I felt after watching Secret in Their Eyes. You know, so that is the reference point for me.
I was watching one of your interviews, Hemant, and in that you mentioned that you were that guy during your engineering days who used to scribble emo stuff in class. And I'm wondering if your next two films, Sapta Sagrada Cello, is born somewhere from there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would say definitely. The seeds of it, at least, for sure.
Right, because that definitely seems like films that a person like that would make.
Yeah. No, it definitely is. I think the origin lies somewhere in those years, for sure. But I realized that, you know, there was this growing disdain towards romance because of how plastically it felt. I started hating the idea of romance. You know, I was like, I don't want to do anything in the romance space because it doesn't feel like it has any. If these two people came out of the screen, they wouldn't be able to walk because there's no feet. They're so plastic, right? So I was like, I wanted to create a love story which has a little bit of personality, which has a little bit of vulnerability, and we feel it. Like your Mani Ratnam films, couples, basically, or, you know, your Korean films, your general, you know, so classics, so to speak. So I was like, okay, maybe somewhere down the line, I'll work on it. But Sapta is the first script that I ever wrote. It never got to do it. I did Godi Banna, then Kavaludari, then I did Sapta. So, yeah.
Yes, yes. And so many things to talk about this film. And so I'm just, I have a long list here. But I wanted to start with the background score because the score is just tremendous. And the strings, the new wave, synth chords. What was your brief like to Charan Raj for the background score?
I write, I prepare, like preparing a playlist when... I have a bit of a monkey brain. It takes a lot for me to focus. It takes a lot for me to streamline my thoughts. There's a lot of insecurities and, you know, fears. So I have to find ways to, you know, stay motivated, get up and find a sense of purpose. So I create playlists. I change my monitor calibration. I change the table from facing the window to this side. It should feel like I've done something. Now I have to work. Now I have no excuses to not work, you know, that sort of a thing. So one of the things that I do is create playlists, which, you know, I like going into that zone. And so when I'm thinking of the scenes or the story and the characters, it usually happens to the backdrop of some music. So, and I've observed that soundtrack is something that I would look to have in the film as well. So those influences. So with Sapta, because it was my third collaboration with Charan after Godi Banna, after Kavaludari, we had sort of developed a working chemistry where I just share the playlist with him and tell him, you know, just listen to this. This is some, And I like listening to all kinds of music. So I go on these, you know, sort of rabbit holes where I search for bands like Nirvana from Eastern European countries. And then I listen to some random thing. And if somewhere I'll find one song. And so I create like this playlist. And so Charan is very curious in terms of what are these random unheard of songs. So he listens to the songs and then we start discussing about the scenes and about the landscape, the musical landscape of the film. And that's how we arrived at the space. And the idea for Side B was that we want something that is in contrast, you know, like a sharp contrast. If we use a lot of, sweet, melodic undertones, then that has to be a little electric. It has to be a little, you know, it should feel that angst we should feel, that emo we should feel. So, you know, so we'll explore it in these spectrums. So that's how we went about it.
Can you share some of the bands or the acts that you had in that playlist?
Synthwave, there was, of course, Weekend was one of the songs that I used to listen to a lot. There was obscure bands that I find it hard to pronounce. A little bit of Dead Mouse that was there. Then there was this, I have it here. I'll just...
Oh, nice.
If you... So one thing that I do is that sometimes I create playlists just for the background score, which will have a lot of pianos, electric, you know, stuff like that. And sometimes it will just be for songs. Sometimes it will be just for the scene, you know. And so I try and make it give Charan as much information as possible. So there was a little bit of Santosh Narayanan from, you know, Santosh Narayanan's work that I had referenced for Charan. Then, of course, Yenga Pona Rasa from Marian, that A.R. Rahman sir had done. Then the soundtrack for 96. This is for the singing bits of her, this actual song that she sings. So those are the kind of songs. And the other bands, their soundtrack for Drive by
yes.
Cliff Martinez.
Yes.
That was a very big reference. So it's like a mixture of many such, right, you know, references. But the thing that is very comforting for me is that Charan is a bit of a genius. So I just share the playlist with him and, you know, he'll do tunes. We have never worked on a song where it is for one situation. Very rarely does that happen. He'll make a tune and I'll be like, okay, I know where to use it. He won't know where I'm using it. But I'll be like, okay, this will go there. I need something in slightly in the jazzy space. So he'll do something in the jazzy space. I'll use it somewhere else. So it's like a weird sort of dance that I really, really enjoy.
Yes. And I love the background score. And the reason I asked you this question was because for a movie that has such a strong emotional core, you know, music is like, you know, it's one of the pillars of that kind of story. I think that's why this movie works like doubly, you know, well, because the story telling is tremendous. And also the music, just the score. I mean, it's gut-wrenching in some extent. Hemant, when you have a story that you're telling across two pictures, right? Was this something, was that a conscious decision or did you ever think about making an epic 4-hour long picture?
It was never a plan to make it into two films, actually, to begin with. It was supposed to be one film. We started shooting and somewhere along the way, I sort of, this was also hit by COVID, a second wave. We had just finished five days of shoot and then COVID second wave hit, which was a considerable break. So we worked on the script. I mean, I had a lot of time, so I kept working on the characters. And I have a lot of backstory for the characters and, you know, their what can happen. And I had done a tremendous amount of research with the jail life and what happens inside the jail. So while shooting the film, while shooting the jail portions, just before the jail portions, I realized that, you know, we are going to be shooting a lot of excess, which I might not use in the film. And I come from very indie filmmaking sort of, you know, mindset. So I was like, I don't want to shoot a film and not use it. I don't want to lose it in the edit table because it's just, you know, it would be a waste of money. So I had a word with my producer, who is Rakshit, who is the actor as well. So he is one of those sweethearts. He's like, he's the director's, you know, the best possible dream. So he was like, you shoot what you want. We'll see. You take a call in edit. If you like it, you will keep it. If you don't want, then remove it. Don't worry about it. So I was like, maybe it can be two films. So he was like, okay, interesting. Let's not think too much about it. You shoot exactly what you want. Let's edit. You edit it and see if you're convinced, then we'll take it forward. Let's not make any announcement. So in my head, I was like, it was like a door that was open and I was free. So I was like, okay, we did the math. We did the calculation in terms of, so I was still finishing the whole film in the same budget. But which is why Rakshit was like, you know, budget is not going to increase drastically. So if I'm going to end up with two films, then it will be bonus. So you freak out, you make the film that you want. So that's how the sort of, you know, I just went and shot it. Even till the last day of the film, the shoot of the film, I was not very clear that it's going to be two films. I just knew that there was a lot of footage and I edit. So while I was editing it, I was like, okay, this is feeling like more like two films, more like two films. And it became very clear when I started doing like the, you know, the finalization of the edits, it became very clear that it has to be presented as two films.
Oh, okay. So until the edit table, this was not even a thought of to starting it. Okay. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. Yes. And then when you have two films, obviously, you know, two parts, the culmination of the first part is kind of key because, you know, it has to be like a cliffhanger. And I think the side A has a great climax. You know, that's, it's, if I remember it correctly, it's Manu walking back from the prison after his sentence hearing. And that's intercut with Priya's wedding. And then I think there is also a nice cut from Priya standing on top of the building, you know, presumably contemplating suicide. And then that cuts to her sort of a nod of approval to her decision to get married to someone else.
Yeah. It
is kind of like a proverbial suicide. So I thought that was a very nice climax. Was that something that you put a lot of effort in while editing to kind of end the first part there?
No, that was written in script. That was actually
That was in the script. Call. Okay.
Yeah, it was very clear that she is going to go to the top, and instead of showing the jump, we show her jumping into the, you know, like you said, the proverbial death of marriage to an unknown man, and that intercuts with him lashing out at prison and ending with the whole thing, the end of the side A would be her opening the door and his door closes. So he's there for 10 years. She's welcoming another man into her life, into her physical space, into her mind, into her body. And then 10 years later, the door opens. So that is the beginning of side B, basically. It was written in the script. While shooting it, I just tried to hit a particular edit rhythm in terms of shot composition, in terms of the geometrics, aesthetics, in terms of if we do a top angle shot here, then we'll do a top angle shot here. If we cut a close up here, then we'll cut to a wide here. So it was very, you know, the choreography was planned in such a way. And it was one of the first sequences that I cracked all the way back. I wrote the script 10 years ago. So this was one of the scenes that I felt like, okay, you know, I've written something that I know is definitely beyond me. You know, I've written something great. It felt like that for the very first time. So that ended up becoming the climax or side A.
Yeah, very cinematic.
Yeah.
And Hemant, another thing I love about this film is Manu's arc. You know, inside A, when we are watching the film for the first time, you know, there's this palpable tension that something's going to go wrong. We know that, but we don't know exactly like what's going to happen, right? Over the course of both the films, side A and side B, you know, we find out that in spite of the awful hand that life has dealt him, Manu never really goes off the rails, right? He never allows his moral compass to get damaged. He remains pretty much a do-gooder, you know, throughout.
Mm.
Even when he wants to punish Prabhu, he doles out commensurate punishment, brings him food, sweets. In the end, leaves the key to the water tanker where he has locked him up for Prakash so that he can let him out. And even with Surbhi, you know, he wishes for her to pursue her dream. But there is one another palpable difference in Manu that can be seen through his arc, that he now is better seasoned at judging people, right? Because in side A, we see that he's right. He trusts his employer. He trusts Prabhu. Yeah. He trusts Som. He even trusts the prisoners who tell him that, hey, Patil is not a nice guy, when in fact, he is the nice guy. But in side B, we see that he's a changed man as far as taking people at face value. And I thought there was this interesting bit where he doesn't judge Deepak right away. You know, he kind of sizes him up a few times before forming an opinion about him. So that particular arc of Manu, can you talk a little bit about that and how, why was it important for you to show that, look, this guy has been through shit and he didn't deserve any of it. But at the same time, I don't want him to like just go rogue and, you know, say, you know, hey, the world has been bad to me. So, you know, I don't mind doing some bad things.
Yeah. For me, I didn't, I felt that could have been the lowest hanging fruit. You know, that was the natural progression. That was a natural idea that my mind immediately went to. But I was like, hey, that is too easy. But, you know, let's see if we can find in a certain way to retain the skeleton of his character, right? People change with time, bad experiences, you know, mold people, their attitude changes, but they don't become antitheses of their own personality. Very rarely does that happen. I mean, it does happen. It's not that it would be very strange if it didn't happen. It's just that for me, it felt even more interesting that there is still this fabric of a good person or a certain innocent person. It's just that he has learned to see, and like you said, see the situation better. And that sort of fit very well with the entire structure, because the only person he can't see well or judge properly is Priya's husband. So that immediately was like, okay, this now is like a good conflict area to explore. So it kind of became very interesting while shooting also, because I used to make Rakshit, because I didn't know what the graph exactly was. I was trying to catch it, right? The character graph, as from a director writer perspective, I kept asking Rakshit to do one more of every performance where it's a little more creepier than the previous one. Where the smile becomes a little creepy, where, you know, the look becomes a little more creepy. And he's like a phenomenal actor. So he was able to give me those, you know, those small little change in tones, like little subtle things which would become very different. So while editing it, I was able to sculpt a certain graph which sort of fit this character. In fact, there were a lot of scenes that were removed, which were giving a completely, it was demonizing Manu too much, or it was making him too harsh, you know. So I had to taper off all the rough edges and smoothen it out to create this sense of, okay, within that person, there exists this innocent person, but also there exists a person who can go to any lengths. So it was something that I had to discover on the edit table.
And did you ever wonder, like, people might see or sense this kind of a contrast between Manu and Priya, that, you know, for Manu, essentially, he makes his life mission to bring back joy to Priya's life. You know, all he wants now is to see her happy. Everything else he has made peace with. Yeah. But not even for once, I think, Priya ever thinks about, hey, what happened to Manu? You know, I mean, she knows he's in the prison for 10 years. she knows that he's going to get out after 10 years. Was that like part of the characterization, or you wanted deliberately to show that kind of a contrast? Because, you know, Priya never finds out about Manu, right? I mean, in the, there is only one fantasy sequence that we will talk about. But other than that, I mean, there is just no connection that she has.
So the two reasons for doing that, one was because I like the idea that we don't know what is in a woman's heart fully, right? That we don't, she's gone through so much that we don't deserve to know, right? So, you know, in a very, very weird way. So I like the idea where I wanted to explore and in many ways free her of judgment. Because the moment you show a married woman still harboring thoughts for her ex, unfortunately, that would be accepted from a societal perspective. That would be far more accepted for a man to do. But if Priya were to be unfaithful, even in thought, it would diminish her character. I didn't want that to happen. And she's the kind of a person who would not acknowledge to her own self because she feels like that is a door that she would never want open. You know, so the another reason was because I wanted that door which opens up to Manu's past and that pain and that life to be the same door that allows her to sing. So for me, I was like, if I open this door, that door should also open somehow, which is what happens in the end. She's not able to sing because she's deeply, you know, those emotions come back, you know, she's hidden it away. Like there is no catharsis for her. She's sort of, and that's how trauma works, right? So for me, one of my absolute favorite scenes in the film is where she's standing and watching this little blind girl sing in the bus stand. We show Priya sort of move, you know, geometrically, if you look at it from space perspective, we see the kid is standing in the same place and Priya is walking closer and closer to her, right? She is moving from her adulthood to her childhood in steps. And she sits down next to her and she says, what is your name? And she says, her name is Shreya, which rhymes with Priya. So it's almost like Priya finding her, you know, her inner child, the child who used to like singing, who used to enjoy it. So for me, that was very intertwined. That trauma was very intertwined with Manu, that she could sing only for him. She had forgotten that she could sing for herself. So that's the main reason why I didn't address it, to maintain that sense of mystery and to stop the judgment on her character.
One more thing, Hemant, you know, I watched Side A in Hindi, the dubbed version. And, you know, I felt this hint of Salim Javed in Patil's dialogues. You know, they're pulpy. They sound like something that someone like Pran might have said in 70s action dramas. You know, hum insaan paida nahi hote, paida hone ke baad insaan hote. Marna aasan hai, jeena mushkil. Was that a deliberate nod or it's just the person who did the...
No. I think it is purely I think it is the work of the dialogue writer, the Hindi dialogue writer, who has brought in those influences. Because in Kannada, it doesn't particularly play out like a Salim Javed line. You know, those Patil's dialogues don't really, it's not in the same space. But I think it is, it's some of the happy accidents of, you know, dubbing the film in different dialects. So the dialect of that region, the cinema of that region invariably gets added on to the version. So it becomes a different film in many ways. But it's very interesting. It's very fascinating. I enjoyed listening to that comparison because I've never thought of it that way.
And, you know, there are instances of humor in both the films too. And, you know, one of my favorite scenes of that humor is the scene where Manu has Priya's hand in one hand and the police guard is sitting next to him.
Yeah.
And he has his hand and he kisses Priya's hand. That's also, you know, it's nice because the whole movie is such a, like I said, it's such a emotional, you know, gut punch. But these kind of light moments, they kind of lighten up the mood a little bit. Yeah, we got to talk about that scene from Side B, Hemant, you know, where Manu dreams of meeting Priya at the cafe. And then we see the walls slide away. We see in the background the sea, and Priya starts walking towards the sea. And I think then the shot cuts to where we see Manu in chains. Like it's all part of his dream slash nightmare.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very graphic novel like imagery.
It's amazing that you picked up on the graphic novel bit. I read a lot of graphic novels. Like right now, there's like 2-3 graphic novels on my table. I don't particularly know if that scene was specifically inspired from a particular graphic novel, but for me, there's this book called Blankets by Craig S. Thompson. It's a graphic novel. So at the beginning of the film, I gifted a copy of, I do that with every film. I try and find a book that I think would best summarize the film and the character. And I would give it to the lead actors. So I'd given Blankets to Rukmini and to Rakshit. That, I think, comes from there. That essence of that book is that scene, basically, between the two people. And that scene read really nicely on paper. When I wrote it and when I bounced off the idea with Gundu and his feedback on it, when we jammed on it, it read really nicely. But nowhere in my wildest dreams did I think the gravity of the performance, of the pauses, the look, the exchanges would enhance it to that level. I cut off from my work very easily. Like once the film is out, it is out of my system. But even to this day, if that scene plays out, I will watch it in its entirety, because there's genuine magic that has happened between two actors there, you know, which was not scripted, which is just their two actors being 200% in the moment in that performance. And, you know, it's a matter of great pride for me to have been on set while it was happening, to watch it happen. So with regard to the door opening, I didn't want it to be a wake up. You know, I didn't want it to feel like it's just another dream, or was it really a fantasy? You know, sometimes when you dream, you have this question in your head. Did I dream it or did it actually happen? You know, that usually happens when you wake up with a certain kind of there is a certain kind of a dream. It doesn't make sense. So I like doing that. Even in my first film, there's a dream sequence where weird things happen. Like the TV is upside down, the furniture is upside down. So I like the idea of, you know, using dreams in that space in a very surreal, slightly misunderstood. It doesn't have to make logical sense because it's a dream, right? The world can be upside down. So a lot of these things were in my mind. And primarily, I wanted to create a feeling where you're left feeling, is this for real? Did it happen? You know? So that was a basic tenet around it. So we discussed that we can do it CG. You know, we can make the walls disappear one by one as they're talking. But somehow the idea of physical effects, of building sets which can alter in shot, it's like the holy grail of filmmaking, right? Especially in the world where everything is VFX. So it's like this extra challenge of, can we do it on camera? You know, can we make this in a way that creates that wow moment on screen, where the audience also knows that this cannot be CG. That wall is actually fucking moving, right? So I had a great production designer, Ullas, who figured it out. When I told him, he was like, ha, we could do this in CG. Because he's the kind of a person whose natural impulse is to say no to begin with. And then slowly work himself into it and then be like, yeah, this is exciting. So me and Advait were very excited. When I bounced off the idea to Advait, he was like, it'll be superb if it opens up. But it threw a lot of physical filmmaking challenges, because the exposure inside the room is low, right? You're exposing for interior light, and beach is harsh sunlight.
So you got to match that, yeah.
You have to match it in shot, right? So that's a very challenging way to go about it. So it was fun. It was, I mean, thankfully, Advait and Ulas are very competent, very, very excellent at their jobs. And they're brilliant, creative, individuals and collaborators. So I was able to achieve exactly what I wanted.
That's a great, great scene. I think that scene is going to time is really going to be a friend of that scene as films itself. I think it's going to become really cult. The action sequence in the climax, Hemant, by God, you just went straight up Korean there, didn't you? They said, let's just go for it now.
Yeah,
the action is tremendous, and the action actually comes as a bit of a surprise, because until then there's very little action, I think, in both the films. Manu just goes straight up Korean from there. So I really loved that. Did you guys work a lot on the action design, or was this?
No, actually, we were in talks with a very accomplished choreographer from the US who work on it, but it somehow things didn't work out, and I ended up working with a very accomplished action choreographer here, Vikram Master, and sort of designed the sequence with him. I am a very big fan of single shots, one-offs. So I had a emotional graph and an emotional script for that sequence. For me, the juxtaposition that happens in side A between Manu and Priya, where sort of Priya is internally self-destructing, Manu is externally going on that destruction path where he doesn't give a damn about himself. So for side B, my emotional sort of script was that what Priya is going through in this whole process of going to sing is a very violent sort of process for her. You know, the amount of trauma that she's trying to revive and open doors to and confront is of very high, it's a very difficult thing. So, and she's sort of being forced to do it. If you actually observe, everybody is asking her to sing. She's been brought there because the husband is like, why don't you try? Even when she's signing, the kid is giving her the form and saying, take it, Amma. So she's not going voluntarily. So there's a certain element of struggle, which I couldn't show from the inside as to what is happening in her. So for me, I wanted that to come out through Manu. So which is why it becomes very, violent. And I wanted it to be get gory. I wanted all that rage also to come out in one side and sort of mimic Priya's mindset. So after one point when Rakshit has beaten everybody in that single shot where we hold the frame, I'm a huge fan of any film buff or a cinephile. Nobody can walk away after watching Old Boy and not remember that sequence. So I was like, in my life, I have to do one Old Boy-esque sequence, but I have to do my own version of it. Like, I have to not copy it. I have to do it in a way that is unique. So I was like, okay, let's build a corridor. Let's do a corridor fight, but let's completely change the dynamics of it. Let's add a very, very suspense film noir element to it, actually speaking. It's East meets West in a way, because the camera is not moving. The character is disappearing from the frame. Just a hand is emerging. So you don't know who is being killed. You're hearing voices. So there is a very rare window-ish sort of approach to it. So I really loved doing that. And max marks to Rakshit, because that sequence without the speed up and the ramping of shots in between, single take, is about 1 minute, 48 seconds. That whole from action to end of him coming out of the room. By the end of it, we did 3 takes. Rakshit is not able to breathe because he's gasping. And he's giving it everything. He's exhausted. One of those guys. He's exhausted. And he's like, do you want to do one more? He would have gone. He would have done it. He would have done 2 more, 3 more. He's that kind of an actor. So it was fabulous shooting it. after that sequence is where it gets into that intercutting comes back, where you see Priya walking into the room, it cuts to Manu's face and it's fully bloody. So he's crawling to Surabhi and Priya is climbing up the stairs. So I wanted that juxtaposition to sort of play out till the point where she can't sing and it literally is a bullet to Manu's heart. You know, the fact that she can't sing is what kills it. So I wanted that thing. So yeah, I massively enjoyed it and I realized I would want to do more action. So my next film, because of this sequence.
Awesome, awesome. That's awesome to hear. And yeah. There's a final great flourish at the end of part B, you know, where there's an overhead shot of what looks like Priya at first on the seashore where she picks up the conch. But actually, it's Surabhi. And that's also a nice touch, I thought, because it kind of nicely bookends this whole epic. So is there hope for some continuation there? Because it does feel like it's like a segue to now Surbi's story. But
I keep getting lots of messages on social media saying, when is Side C releasing? When is Side D releasing? You did cassette A, B. Why don't you do CD now? I'm like, boss, I did this for 3.5 years. I'm tired. I want to do action film now.
And Eamon, what can you tell us about Tenali? When is that coming?
Tenali is going to take a little bit of time, yeah. Because Rakshit is directing two films. He's doing Richard Anthony now, and then after that he's doing Punyakoti. So both are very large canvas, beautiful stories. So it will take Rakshit at least 2-3 years to finish those films. So until then, I have a couple of films that I want to do. Okay. So we'll meet again.
Definitely. Yes, yes. Finally, Hemant, we're going to play a round of rapid fire game, okay, that I call Shoot. You know, where, okay, I'm going to shoot you questions and you're going to shoot back answers to me without thinking too much. Okay. Ready?
Yeah.
An Indian filmmaker whose films you eagerly await.
Mani Ratnam.
A deceased filmmaker who you wish you had a chance to assist.
Ritvik Ghatak.
Favorite Bachchan film.
Weirdly, first thing that comes to my mind is Anand.
One Rajkumar film you would recommend to folks outside India?
Dr. Rajkumar?
Yes.
There's so many. CID 999. It's just the style. I mean, there are way more deeper, nicer films like Babruana and all that. They were the mythological epics. But I love CID 999. It's a take on James Bond.
Yes, yes. Favorite Coen Brothers film?
The one with the wife, I forget the name. Wife of the Coen brothers, where she shoots in the end through the wall. The other one is the film about writer's block that they wrote.
Yes. Barton Fink.
Barton Fink, yeah.
Favorite Asghar Farhadi film?
Oh, A Separation. And Le Pass. Actually, I would put Le Pass first and then Separation.
Okay. Last Indian film that blew your mind?
I saw Goat Life recently. And the film stayed with me. Like, it's very weird. I saw it 3 days ago. And there are times when the visual imagery just keeps coming back. So yeah, I'd say that.
Okay. A genre that you would like to explore in Hindi?
Proper angry young man, Amitabh sir.
Mainstream masala, yeah. Back to the classic.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very Salim Javed sir space.
So you can work with that Hindi dialogue, right?
Exactly.
One classic which you would love to reimagine?
Any language?
Any language.
Casablanca, maybe?
Oh, very nice. One B film that you absolutely adore?
What is that film with all the... I forget the name, but there are quite a few. You're talking about B-grade films, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, one of those Jani Dushman or one of those Janwar, Pistar Par Janwar from films.
Right, right. Those double meaning titles and all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I still love those films. I just the sound of it is like, first take my money. They just buy, give me 10 tickets. I want to watch Pistar Par Janwar.
You know, Hemant, I'm just going to cut this out, this bit, and use it for my viral marketing, right?
yeah, sure, sure.
really super. Appreciate it. And I know we went over time, so I'm sorry about that. But
I had a great time. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Hemant.
If you liked the episode, do consider supporting the show. Your support will help me continue creating content like this. You can find the link for supporting the show in the show notes and on the pod website. Also, do share this episode on Twitter, Insta, or Facebook. And do subscribe, rate, and review the pod wherever you listen to your pods. You can follow me on Twitter and Insta at loveofcinemasf8. Feel free to reach out there or by email with your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find my email in the show notes. That's the episode. This is Himanshu signing off. And as always, thank you for listening to the Love of Cinema podcast.